Pastor Fay touched on here a few weeks ago. I believe he gave the same sermon here, I don't know, it's probably been 3 or 4 weeks ago now, that he did up in Beloit, and I happened to hear it there. And I would like to go into a little bit more of the things that he touched on there, the one aspect, I should say, that he touched on. I think today, if there's any time we need to be thinking about living by faith, because people can say, just as the Apostle James, who has been derided by lots of religious people, they don't like what he wrote in the book of James, because he said, faith without works is dead. And they are not happy with it, because that means you have to do something. They like to say, and only quote the verses that show that if you just believe, that's all you have to do. And he makes the statement, he asks the question without turning there. James asks the question, well, do the demons and does Satan believe in God? And the answer is yes. So what does that prove? You can say you believe in God, you can say you believe, but unless you follow or live that way, live by faith and by the faith that you have and by what you believe in, it's really worthless, isn't it? That's why I said faith without works, without action, without living that way is emptiness. It doesn't mean anything. You know, Satan can recite the Bible backwards. And he quoted scriptures to Christ, didn't he? He misquoted them, or twisted them, I shouldn't say. He didn't misquote them, but he misapplied them. But he knows the Bible, but he certainly does not live by it. So just because you believe doesn't really make any difference. You have to obviously believe, but you have to learn to live or to practice what you believe and conduct yourself based on that. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 10. I really like this particular verse, and I wish we had more time. I remember in college we used to have private Bible studies among the students, sometimes in the evening. And one of the things that we really enjoyed doing, and it's based on 1 Corinthians 10, was to go to the Old Testament, as this chapter shows us. And, well, we'll talk about that in a moment. Okay, 1 Corinthians 10, he begins talking about the Israelites going through the Red Sea, and they went through a type of baptism when they went through the sea. And he said in verse 2, and they were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and did all eat the same spiritual meat. They all had the same information, and they all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Jesus Christ. Okay, so here was Christ guiding and directing the Israelites out in the wilderness. But with them, God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now notice what it says here in verse 6, and I'm sure all of you are familiar with this, but this is what we want to do today, is review these things. Now these things, all those things in the Old Testament, and this is just an example of some of the things that he's referring to, now these things were our examples to the intent or purpose that we should not lust or covet after evil things as they also lusted or coveted. So that all these examples were written down and kept in history here in the Bible for our benefit, so that we would learn some spiritual lessons from what they went through. It's an interesting story. Many of the children have seen the movie The Ten Commandments over and over, and it's an interesting story, and it's exciting. However, there are some important spiritual lessons that we need to draw from them, and that's why Paul specifically takes, you know, about a third of this chapter or half of this chapter to expound on the fact of how important those lessons are. So what he's saying is go back and read, go back and look at what these people went through and learn lessons from that so that you don't fall into the same trap, because that was human nature in the raw. I mean, just think about it for a minute. Here are the Israelites. They have the Egyptians coming with the chariots and the horses and this, you know, the dust coming up, and they look the other direction, and here are the mountains, and they look a little bit further to the east, and there's the Red Sea, and they're stuck in the corner, and here come the Egyptians with the chariots and the knives and spears and so on, ready to wipe them out. Now, God stopped the Egyptians temporarily, and he opened the Red Sea, and Moses had to tell them basically to sit down and shut up and see the salvation of the Eternal, which is a wonderful, powerful statement. And they went across the Red Sea and on dry land, and then the Egyptians decided that looked like a good thing to do as well, and they jumped down into the bottom of the Red Sea, and then the sea covered them all and killed all of them, and the Israelites were safe on the other side. It wasn't a few days later, and they were complaining again. We had it better back in Egypt with the leeks and the garlics and the flesh pots. And they would constantly attack Moses time after time and accuse him when he went up on the mountain. What was the thing they did? 40 days, you know, he was gone on the mountain, and they're making the golden calf and doing all these awful things. And a lot of them died as a result of that. And ultimately, all of them died in the wilderness and never did get into the promised land. They were offered by God blessings or cursings. Which do you want? And all the Israelites said, "We'll take the blessings. Thank you very much." And God's answer quietly to himself was, "Oh, that there were a heart in them that they would keep my commandments." But they didn't have the Holy Spirit, and they certainly weren't intending to keep God's laws and his commandments and really have faith in him. The next generation was trained by God from the time they were young, and they did trust God, and they went into the promised land. But that first generation all died in the wilderness because they never did trust God. And they went through, we had all kinds of situations and stories that in itself is a very, very interesting but long story. Now, that's an example of what not to do, and we can learn just as much from what not to do as what we can learn from what to do. We want to look at an example today of what to do, however. And if you go back here to 1 Corinthians, in verse 6, it talks about not falling into the same traps. He went on to refer to people being idolaters. They, you know, overate. They drank. You know, did all the things. They committed fornication in verse 8 and in verse 9. And he said, neither let us tempt or try. You're not really tempting Christ. That's the wrong word here in King James, but you're testing God or tempting God in the sense, just like Satan quoted to Christ, you know, throw yourself down and the angels will take care of you, and Christ quoted the fact that you shouldn't tempt the Lord your God. So they were destroyed in the wilderness. They murmured, they complained, they griped. They did everything human and carnal, selfish. They were only looking to themselves. And verse 11, now all these things happened to them for examples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. So these things were written for our benefit as examples of what not to do, and in some cases what to do. Wherefore, let him that thinks he stand take heed lest he fall. And that's a very important warning. And we always need to be examining and looking at ourselves and making sure that we are trusting God for what He's given us, and that we're walking by faith and not just by sight and by what looks good to us, but by what we know God says to do regardless. Because lots of times we have run into things in our lives, haven't we, where it looks like, well, you know, that seems like the right thing to do. I should probably do that. But then you think, you know, you think of what the Bible says, but it says, nah, you shouldn't do that. So what may seem right to a man, as Proverbs says, can lead you into destruction. The way that seems right to a man isn't necessarily the right thing to do. It always has to be confirmed by what God says. Let's go to Hebrews 11. I just want to read before we get to the Old Testament here. I'll give you a little insight into the thinking of the man that we're going to be looking at, who is probably, well, he's probably the best example, he and his wife, of living by faith. Okay, 1 Corinthians 11 lists off, or I'm sorry, Hebrews 11 lists off all of the patriarchs that were noted for having faith. And in verse 6 it says, without faith it's impossible to please God. Now obviously the people, you know, in the wilderness didn't have very much faith. They didn't trust God. As soon as they couldn't see something, they didn't have enough water, we're sick of this lousy manna, we want meat, we want this, we want that. They just were looking, you know, couldn't see past the end of their nose, as people say. So that's why God says in verse 6 that if we don't have faith, if we don't truly trust God, then it's impossible to please God. Well, of course. That's the basis of what God called us to do, is to learn to submit ourselves and to trust God and to obey and do what He says. You can't always see the outcome. God says, do this. But you can't see how that's necessarily going to work out. You don't see that a lot of times, or most of the time, until after it's already done. Then you look back and you say, oh, wow, that worked out pretty good. I would never have thought of that circumstance working out for me. And some of the things in life are, you know, they seem very obvious, various trials that we are faced with. But you don't see this huge picture that God sees, and He's already figured it all out for you, and He's going to let you go through this, and you're going to be looking at, oh, this is the real big problem. All of a sudden, that problem goes away, and He opens the door to an opportunity that you had no comprehension of, you didn't plan for, you didn't think about, and all of a sudden it's like, wow, I thought we were going over here, but it looks like, you know, this opportunity has come along. And some of you will understand what I am saying, and others will come to understand as time goes along. It's just, you don't, most of the time, you don't understand exactly how it's going to work out. I've told you this before. When I was about a sophomore in college, I was back here during the summer, and Mr. Armstrong came through from England with his wife, and my father was called to an elders meeting here in Chicago, and all the elders from the surrounding area, I know there were probably 15 ministers there, all sitting around in the local pastor's living room. Mr. Armstrong and his wife were sitting there in this, kind of in the center, talking, taking questions, and giving a report on how things were going in England and different things. And there was a pause in the conversation, and I won't go into all the background of the details, but all of a sudden Mrs. Armstrong, nobody was saying anything. Mr. Armstrong was finished with whatever he was saying, and she looked at me and she said, you didn't like the decision I made, did you? And these guys all looked at me, and I'm like, huh? Someday I'll tell you what was all behind that. But anyway, I had come to understand some things, and this was some personal decisions that were affecting my life. And so anyway, I did understand why she made this particular decision, and it was interesting. Well, Mr. Armstrong was very well aware of the whole situation, unbeknownst to me, and so he later looked at me when our little conversation was done and my embarrassment was over with, and he said, "David," he said, "one thing to remember is that God will never work things out the way you think he will." And I've not been disappointed with that yet. Because we're just not smart enough to figure out the way God will do it. And even if we happen to stumble across it, he can do it a different way. He'll just work it out in a way that will surprise you. And this is where you have to have faith. You can't always see the end result. And we're going to see this in the example here of Abraham that we're going to look at. Because he couldn't see the end result for a long, long time. He was told what was going to happen, but he couldn't see, and he tried this and that, and finally, through experience and continuing to follow what God said, he saw that God was simply going to do what he said. And that's one of the things that we need to learn in life, is that God will always do what he says. Now, we can't guarantee that we can always do what we say. We might tell the children this afternoon on Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock we're going out for ice cream. And the kids, yeah, great. But first we need to get such and such done. Okay, that's the deal. 2 o'clock comes, the phone rings, and some other thing happens that surpasses the importance of going to get ice cream. And now you have to explain to them why we can't go get ice cream, and the big long faces and the tears and all these other things. But you said. The difference between us and God is God can do what he says, and he does do what he says no matter what, and he always does it, and you can guarantee that that's what will take place. Whereas humanly we have a hard time understanding that. So he said, without faith it's impossible to please God. For he that comes to God, okay, we say we believe, must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. Like James said, living that way, doing it, following it. And all then he starts giving all these examples by Noah. Noah had to wait, 120 years? Before what God said was going to take place happened. In the next verse, Noah being warned of God of the things not seen as yet, he went ahead and did it anyway. He prepared the ark, got laughed at. Nobody could see what the purpose. They thought that nutcase out there, building a boat in the middle of the field. And it wasn't for a year or 10 years, but for 120 years. That's a long time. The weeds are growing, you know. I mean, he was the laughingstock, I'm sure, the byword of the neighborhood. Faith, by faith in verse 8, Abraham, when he was called to get up out of his comfortable family environment, did what God said. And he took off in verse 9, and he went into the land of promise, into a strange country, dwelling in tents, and with Isaac and Jacob and their heirs with him of the same promise. For, verse 10, they were looking, for he looked for a city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. He wasn't looking for a ready-made physical city to walk into. And then he mentions Sarah here, who had to learn and build and develop faith. Didn't start out with as much faith as she needed, but ended that way. And verse 13, they all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them, in other words, because of their faith and having believed what God said, afar off, and were persuaded of them and embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. They accepted the fact that they were just temporary dwellers on this earth. And that's where we all are for right now. This is training ground. The real excitement will come when Christ returns, and that's when we're really going to be building something for the future. This is preparation. This is letting man do what he wants, letting Satan have his way within reason, you know, in other words, without totally destroying the earth, and letting man do all these things so that man knows by experience what will result if they don't follow God. And that's why we're on this earth, and we have the opportunity to be given insight and be able to live as lights in the world, little group here and there, understanding the truth and looking forward to what's coming. And this is the insight that I wanted to share with you in verse 17. By faith, Abraham, when he was tried, which is, keep this in the back of your mind, offered up Isaac, and he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, because as far as Abraham was concerned, as you will see in the story, it was a done deal. Of whom it was said that in Isaac shall your seed be called. So he was told all these things, which we'll read, but he said in verse 19, this was what was in Abraham's mind at the time, accounting that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from whence also he received him in a figure. So he knew that regardless, God was going to fulfill the promise he gave, even if he had to resurrect his son. But he was going to do what God said. Abraham had to learn, and Abraham did not come to that point in faith in 5 minutes. And he didn't come to it in 5 years, and he didn't come to it in 25 years necessarily. It was a long period of time. So let's go back here to Exodus 12th chapter, I believe. Did I say Exodus? I should say, I meant Genesis. Let's go back to Genesis 12. I want to get to the other translation here. And this is when Abraham is asked to leave his home. Now, many of you have lived in the same general area. Maybe you've moved. Maybe you've moved up in the world from an apartment to a small house and then to a bigger house. But you generally have been here in the Chicago area. You know where the good hardware stores are. You know where, if you want to buy clothing, where the best deal is. You've got your auto mechanic all scoped out. You know where to take your car. And all those things are, you know, you just take it for granted. Well, I'm going to tell you something. After being moved around all over the country, you realize how much you take for granted when you're suddenly plopped down in a brand new environment. Where's a good mechanic? Who can fix my car? What's the best grocery store to go to? Where's a good hardware store? Man's got to have a good hardware store to go to. And all the other services that you already know where to go to get. And you have to relearn all of that each time you move. Each time you get transferred, it is an experience. When you have your family around, when you have your children, as you get older and your children grow up and they're all living in the near close proximity, that's a very nice thing. When your relatives, aunts, uncles, cousins, and so on, they're close, you can have family reunions. Unlike what we face in this world, where, you know, we have people here who have relatives that live in Australia, a couple of folks. You want to go see your son, you got to have to get on an airplane and fly for 16 or 18 hours, and it's not nice. And you get to see them maybe once or twice a year. That's not good. You get these interface situations where you get to see your grandchildren, and then 6 or 8 months later, you get to see them again, and they've gone through this whole growing process, and that's not a comfortable, nice environment. It's much better to be close with your family and be in reasonable proximity. You have all these services. You kind of get into a groove. Well, Abraham was in the groove. He was about 75, and all his family and his relatives were there. He'd been living there who knows how long, and he was pretty well settled. And for God to come along at the age of 75, in chapter 12 and verse 1, and have God tap you on the shoulder and say, okay, get out of your country, from your kindred, and from your father's house. Now there's, you know, when you've been there for a long time, there's a lot of security there. You've got your father's house, all of his possessions that you are ultimately going to be responsible for. You've got to kind of take care of your family, your parents, and so on. It's all intertwined. He said, I want you to get out of there. I want you to leave the comfort of all of your relatives and leave the comfort of your father's house, and I want you to go to a land that I'm going to show you. He didn't even tell him what land he was going to end up in. And verse 2, and I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. Well, that's nice. But in the meantime, I have to leave, and all I have in my hand, well, I don't have anything in my hand, do I? I just have a promise that God's going to make my offspring a great nation, and I'm going to make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And isn't that a true statement? The families, I mean, how many thousands of years now have gone by before the total fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham that we are living through? Sorry to say, it seems to me like we have hit the peak and we are now over the top and we're going down the other side. But that's what it seems like right now. God has fulfilled his promise. God has done what he said he was going to do. And haven't the nations of this earth been blessed because of the blessings that God's given us as a result of Abraham? If we were not here as a country, I mean, how many countries do you know that go into world war, totally annihilate their enemy? You know, over in Japan, for example, they were doing, and one of our people here was the bombardier on one of the airplanes that was bombing Tokyo and other Japanese cities. Those cities are all made of wood. We dropped incendiary bombs. We were burning down their cities. We wouldn't need to have the atomic bomb or the A-bomb or whatever it was then. We didn't need that. We could have totally destroyed that country very easily. We were already in the process of doing it. But, and then on the other end, we have had people, one of our members who has since died recently in the last year or so, who was a gunner on one of the bombers going into Germany and into Europe, and totally destroying those cities. There was nothing left. It was just rubble. They would get a firestorm going. 1,000 bombers. Do you know how many bombers 1,000 bombers are? I was from here to there from Bud Anderson, one of the famous fighter pilots in World War II. And he said in his explanation that he said there were 1,000 bombers in this flight. It took us about 10 minutes to fly from one end, and this is going at 400 miles an hour, 10 minutes to fly from the back part of the bomber flight up to the front. He said we were flying towards the back, flying escort. And we got a call that the bombers were being attacked in the front of the formation. And so it took us about 10 minutes to get up there. There were so many bombers, and you know the contrails? You know what that is? See the jet contrails? Same thing happened with the bombers, B-17s. They would hit a certain altitude right moisture, and there were contrails. He said, we created our own overcast. There were so many airplanes. If you've ever heard of a big four engine, a radial engine B-17 fly over, it makes a lot of noise. You multiply that by 1,000, and you are on the ground anticipating getting bombed. Okay, we annihilated Germany. And then when we were all done, we went in with our money and our help, and we rebuilt all of Europe that was destroyed. We rebuilt Japan. We taught them things. We sent this one man over, I can't remember his name offhand, and he taught them how to manufacture. And they jumped on all of that guidance and direction. It took years, but we rebuilt everything we destroyed of our enemy. Now, do you know any other people, when they conquer a country, go in and rebuild and develop them into competitors of theirs? This world has been greatly blessed by Britain and the United States. They'd be hurting a lot worse if it weren't for us. Now, that's coming to an end, and you begin to see, you know, our capabilities are becoming more and more limited because we're just, frankly, running out of money. We have spent and spent and spent. But what God said came true, but it took a long time. That's why in Hebrews 11 it said they never saw the actual results. He left home. He pulled up his whole family, everybody, all his near relatives, and he left on a promise from God. That's all he had. And he never did see the full results of that promise at all. So Abraham in verse 4 departed as the Lord had told him to do, and his nephew Lot went with him, and Abraham was 75 years old when he departed. So he was at the point where you're well established and you want to kind of take life a little easier. But this is when his life began. So Abraham and Lot and his wife and all the other people that he had accumulated through the years that worked for him and so on, they all took off. And they all started heading out of there. And if I remember correctly, they headed south out of there. But I may not be accurate in that. Yes, I am. In verse 7, and he appeared to be, and the Lord appeared to Abraham, and he reinforced, he says, to your descendants I will give this land. And there he built an altar. And as he moved down to this next area, he built another altar. And verse 9, so Abraham journeyed, going on, still forward to the south. But he didn't know where he was going. God was telling him, just, okay, I want you to keep going this direction, and I want you to keep moving, and I'm going to do so-and-so for you. Now, one of the things that shows his initial lack of faith that he had to learn was in the next couple of verses. He was about to enter Egypt, and his wife, even though she was 70-some years old, or probably in her late 60s, whatever, was a very beautiful woman. And so, because there was a famine, in verse 10, now there was a famine in the land, and Abraham went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. And it came to pass that when he was close to entering Egypt, just about to go over the border, that he told his wife Sarah, indeed I know that you are a woman of beautiful countenance. Therefore, it will happen, when the Egyptians see you, that they will say, this is his wife, and they will kill me, but they will let you live. And so in order for me to stay alive, I want you to tell them, in verse 13, please say that you are my sister, that it may be well with you, or with me for your sake, and that I may live because of you. Now, she technically was a half-sister, because, as he explains here, she wasn't the daughter of his mother, she was the daughter of his father. Okay? hope I have that remembered correctly. Anyway, so sure enough, they get down into Egypt, and the princess Pharaoh, they look at her, and they go, oh, that's, she really looks beautiful. Let's take her to Pharaoh's house, which they did. And he treated Abraham well for her sake in verse 16, and he had sheep and oxen and so on. But the Lord, verse 17, plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. Now, God was going to fulfill what he said, and he was not going to allow anything to stop that. And Pharaoh called Abraham and said, what is this you've done to me? Why did you tell me, obviously he found out, that she was your, it wasn't, why didn't you tell me she was your wife? So she was returned, and Pharaoh commanded the men concerning him, and they sent him away and his wife and all that he had. Nothing happened. But Abraham could have shown more faith in this situation. All right, so then he leaves in chapter 13. He leaves Egypt. He has a lot of physical possessions at this point. Abraham was very rich, verse 2, in livestock and in silver and gold. God was certainly blessing him. Lot also had a great deal that he had developed through the travels and through the time, and they were dwelling together, but there was no more room, and the herdsmen began to argue, and there was strife. And verse 8, Abraham said, please let there be no strife between you and me, between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brethren. And so Abraham said, look, we have to separate. You can go this way, or you tell me, whichever way you want to go, you have first choice, I'll go the opposite. And so Lot looked out in verse 10. He saw the watered plains of Jordan, which included Sodom and Gomorrah. And as it says, that was before Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. And so that's where he chose to go. And he was more of a city dweller. And so he ended up in Sodom eventually. And Abraham dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain and pitched his tent even as far as Sodom, in verse 12. So, and then verse 13 said the men of Sodom were very wicked and sinful against God. But it wasn't until they separated that verse 14, and the Lord said to Lot, separate yourself, or now that you have separated, lift up your eyes now and look from the place where you're standing, northward, southward, eastward, westward, for all of the land which you see I give to you and your descendants forever. But he didn't actually own it, and didn't ever really own it, as God said he would while he was even alive. He was able to dwell in these different areas, and he became very, very wealthy and very strong, and he had many, many people in his company that worked for him. And so he became strong, stronger than his enemies, and they respected him, and they made peace with him. But technically, he didn't own all of the ground that was there yet. And he said, I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth. He keeps repeating this over and over. The next, I won't go through this whole thing because it'll take too long, but the next chapter is rather interesting. The kings were warring against one another. Ultimately, it involved the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah. They weren't strong enough to withstand the fighting. The two kings from Sodom and Gomorrah ran up into the hills, took off. Lot and his family were captured, and that was it. Somebody escaped, came back, told Abraham what was going on in verse 13. And in verse 14, when Abraham heard that his brother had been taken captive, he armed his 318 trained servants who were born in his own house and went to pursue them as far as Dan. And he divided his forces by night. He attacked them. He pursued them. He got Lot back. He got all of the goods back. And he brought them back towards Sodom. And the king of Sodom, in verse 17, came out to meet them. And he was obviously very, very happy to get all the people back and everything else. But Abraham refused to take anything from the king. And in the same at the same time, Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine, and he was the as it says, the priest of the of God Most High, and he blessed Abraham, and Abraham paid him tithes. And as far as we know, that was, or certainly represented Christ, or was a direct represent. But anyway, it showed that Abraham did pay tithes to God. And then verse 21, and the king of Sodom said, here, just give me the people back, and you take all the goods for yourself, all the things you've captured. And Abraham said, no. He said, I am not going to even take a shoelace. The only thing I'm going to take is my expenses for the men having gone out into this battle, because if I take anything, then you are going to say, I have made Abram rich. And he knew it was God who had blessed him. So he didn't take a thing. He wasn't doing it for that reason. He was trying to rescue his relatives and correct the wrong. All right, next chapter shows that God predicts. Once again, he tells him, repeats this promise again. And in verse 5 here, or actually verse 4, this one shall not be your heir, because he was saying, well, now won't you let maybe people born in my house here, you count him as the heir. And again, this Abraham was trying to figure this thing out, because time's going by. He keeps moving. He keeps running into these things. And the years are going by, and God keeps promising he's going to have this these descendants. He's getting older. His wife's past being able to have a child. And it's just, he's trying to figure out, how is this going? He said, well, maybe what we should do is if you just count one born in my house as my heir, then that'll satisfy it, and then we'll go on from there. In verse 4, he said, behold, the word of the Lord came to him and said, this one shall not be your heir, but one who will come from your own body shall be your heir. Oh, okay. And he brought him outside and said, again, now look toward the heaven. Count the stars if you're able to number them, and so shall your descendants be. Now, all he has right now is a promise. That's it. Words. He looks out, he sees all those things out there. But he doesn't have any child or son. And he's trying to figure out, how does God want me to do this? Wouldn't you be asking the same thing? He's no different than we were. But he was learning to live by faith. He was doing what God said. He was following what God said, but he had these questions in his mind. And he was learning to have, or building is the proper word, he was building faith. And God just kept repeating the same thing. And verse 8, or 6, I should say, and he believed in the Lord, he accepted what God said, even though he couldn't see it, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. And then later in the chapter, God mentions the fact that in the future, his descendants, which he didn't have yet, were even going to be going into captivity for 400 years, but they would come out with great possessions, of course, the time of Moses. Okay, in verse 16, or chapter 16, now Sarah gets involved in the situation, and she comes up with a great idea. She starts out here in verse 1, and she's trying to figure out, how is this going to happen? Because, well, I can't have any children, and yet, you know, God keeps promising, reiterating the same thing. Well, maybe it's just like our children, and our son Matt was the great negotiator. No matter what his mother would say, she would say, well, you can't do that. Okay, what about this, though? And I'm upstairs, and I'm listening down in the kitchen, and artists would say, now, you can't do this, whatever it was. And Matt would, okay, but how about this? And he'd present another plan. No, you can't do that. Then he'd go, well, what about this thing? And then, and I had to come down. I said, look, this is not negotiable, you know. Mom said, this is the way it is, that's the way it is. But he would always come up with ways around. Well, how about this? And the funniest thing to me is when he had his own children, or has his own children, and he loved to play with them, and his wife told the children, I about fell off the chair laughing. She tells the children, no, you can't do this, such and such, whatever it was. And And then he intervenes and goes, well, how about so-and-so? Maybe they could do this. I'm like, oh, man, some things never change. But anyway, this is how our minds work, and some people are better negotiators than others. And so Sarah was negotiating here a little bit, and her mind, she said, well, maybe this is what God wants us to do. Sarah, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children, none, zero, all these years. And she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarah came to Abraham, and she said, well, now the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Lays that on God. Please go into my handmaid, or perhaps I shall obtain children by her. And Abraham heeded the voice of Sarah, and she gave her handmaid to him, and so on. In verse 4, and he went, when Hagar saw that she had conceived, then her mistress became despised in her eyes. Of course, this was backfiring in Sarah's face. And Sarah said to Abraham, my wrong be upon you. I gave you my maid into your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, I became despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between you and me. This was not a good decision on her part, nor Abraham. Abraham should have been smarter or wiser. So anyway, it became a big problem, and it didn't end. And finally, the handmaid was going to leave, but God turned her around and said, look, you're going to have a child, and I'll take care of him, and I'll take care of you, and so on. So they were all back together again, but not under the nicest conditions, because Sarah tried to work it out her own way, some way that she could see it was going to happen, instead of simply believing and living by what God said. By this time, in chapter 17, Abraham's 90 years old. Now he went from 75, 85, 90, and once again, verse 1, Abraham was 90 years old, and the Lord appeared to Abraham again. I am Almighty God, he said. Walk before me and be blameless. This is what he's telling us. You become perfect, as Christ said, as your Father in heaven is perfect. It says be, but it should be translated become. This is what we should be striving for. This is what God is telling Abraham. You become blameless, or be blameless. Follow and do what I say. And I will make you make my covenant between me and you, and will multiply you exceedingly. And he repeats this again. And then he gives him a new name. He said, you're going to be the father of many nations, and you're not Abram anymore, you're Abraham. For I have made you, in verse 5, a father of many nations. Then he institutes the thing of circumcision in the rest of the chapter. And finally, and this is rather interesting, in verse 21, let me see here. I'm getting out of breath here. Okay, verse 15. He said, as for Sarah, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, if I'm pronouncing it, but it shall be Sarah. And I will bless her and also give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings and peoples shall be from her. Abraham fell on his face. And verse 17, he still didn't have the full amount of faith that he would have later on. He had to learn. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? And shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? And Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. I wish you'd please accept him. It'd make life so much easier. He's already here. He's been circumcised. Everything's going down the trail. Born in the house. I wish you'd accept him. And God said, verse 19, no, Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. So he had a name before he was even conceived. And I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant, and with his descendants after him. And as for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I have blessed him, and I will make him fruitful, and I will multiply him exceedingly. He shall beget 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. But, verse 21, my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this set time next year. 1 year from now, you're going to have a son, and Sarah will bear it. So when Abraham was 99 years old, he was circumcised himself. Okay, in the next chapter, this is the example of the three angels that come down, and from what we see here, it seems like one of them was Christ, and they go to check out Sodom and Gomorrah to see if the words or the reports that they were getting, if it was really as bad as the reports said. And once again, it shows human nature here in verse 9, chapter 18. Then they said to him, where is Sarah your wife? They were saying to Abraham, because he greeted them. He told his wife to, quick, let's prepare a nice meal for them. They went out and killed the fatted calf type of thing. And they were in the process of eating. And the angel said, well, where's your wife? And he said, she's here in the tent. And verse 10, and he said, I will certainly, this is chapter 18, verse 10, and he said, I will certainly return to you according to the time of life, and behold, Sarah your wife shall have a son. Now, all these promises have been going on, and nothing has changed as far as God is concerned, but Abraham tried this little trick, and Sarah tried that, and oh yeah, I wish you'd just accept Ishmael, that would make life easier. All of these problems he created for himself that he could have avoided had he simply trusted God. But God wasn't ready to do it. Time went by. Years went by. God kept repeating the same promise. And Abraham believed it, but he couldn't see how it was going to work out. But he kept walking, and he was growing in faith. He made mistakes along the way, and just like we do. But you have to keep living by it. And verse 10, and he said, I will certainly return to you according to the time. I already read that. And he said, and Sarah was... Oh, now this is the interesting thing. I always get a kick out of this. He said, I certainly will return to you, in verse 10, to your time of life. Behold, Sarah will have a son. And Sarah, standing behind the tent flap, heard what was being said. Now she was 99 years old. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, well advanced in age, and Sarah had passed the age of childbearing. Therefore, Sarah laughed within herself, like, right. After she said to her, was thinking in her mind, after I have grown old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also? And the Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh? Now, this has got to be pretty embarrassing. You know, there's only a tent flap separating you and you're on the other side of the tent flap. You hear what they're saying. Sarah's thinking to herself, oh, man, this is never going to happen. How could this be? And immediately the Lord said to Abraham, why did she laugh? Now, she didn't laugh out loud. She was just doing this to herself, saying, shall I surely bear a child since I am old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son. Is anything too hard for God? We would go, no. It's not too hard for God. Nothing's too hard for God, but how's God going to do this? I mean, we would accept that statement, right? But actually seeing it take place, figuring out how it's going to happen, living through it, seeing the end results and being patient until God does what he says. Is anything too hard for the Lord? I'm going to do what I said I'm going to do, and according to the time of life, Sarah shall have a son. And verse 15, but Sarah denied it. She denied that she laughed, and saying, I did not laugh, for she was afraid. And the Lord said, no, but you did laugh. That's a pretty awkward position to be in. And that definitely taught her a lesson, because human nature was going, well, this is ridiculous. But in her mind. But of course, God could read her mind and read her thoughts and knew exactly what happened. And he had to correct that and make sure that she understood, I will do what I say. And you will have a son. So then this shows an example here of the level of relationship that he had with the Lord. He begins to negotiate a little bit here with God. And when he found out he was going to destroy the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, and he said, well, if there be 50 righteous left in the city, would you destroy them? No. And then he said, well, what about 45? And then what about 40 and 30 and 20? And finally he got down to 10. If there were just 10 righteous people, Christ said, I will not destroy the city. But the city got destroyed. And when Lot came out, probably Lot was one of the only ones that was righteous. His wife obviously wasn't, because she looked back and longing, wishing she were able to go back. He said not to look back. And in chapter 19 and verse 26, she became a pillar of salt. And I saw something on TV the other day where they were claiming that maybe this was Lot's wife as a pillar of salt. I don't know. Some of these things they claim, who knows. But okay, I won't talk to you about Abimelech here. And this is that same, Abraham kind of falls into the same problem again with his wife and being the sister and all this. But let's get to chapter 21. And the Lord visited Sarah as he had said. So finally, after all these years, at least 25, okay, from 75 years of age to 100, finally God does exactly what he said he was going to do. Now, 25 years to God is nothing. It's a long time to us. Many of us, 25 years from now, won't be around, okay? At least as living, breathing humans. 10 years in our life, if you add 10 years to your life, that can make a big difference. 20 years, 25 years, that's a lot, you know? But it's nothing to God. All right, he kept Abraham going until he was 100 years old, and exactly the way God said. Now here's Abraham trying to figure this, his wife trying to figure around, well, what does God want us to do? Well, maybe this. Well, maybe that. No, God said, I'm going to do this. Yeah, but if you do this, or maybe you could accept that. Finally, they begin to realize, guess what? God will do exactly what he said. When God tells us his laws, all these things, he wants us to do exactly what he says. That's the lesson, one of the major lessons, and that's part of, or that is the major foundational point, I should say, of living by faith. Can't always see the end result. Abraham couldn't see the end result till it happened. He didn't know how it was going to work out. It's never going to work out the way we think it's going to work out. In this case, God actually told him what was going to happen, but it was still beyond his human capability of understanding because of all these physical circumstances. So chapter 21, and the Lord visited Sarah, verse 1, and he said that the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived, bore Abraham a son in his old age at the set time of which God had spoken to him. So he didn't tell him when this was going to happen until about a year prior, after 24 years of giving him the same promise over and over. And Abraham called his name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac. And then Abraham circumcised his son, Isaac, when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. Now Abraham was 100 years old when he had his son Isaac, was born to him. And Sarah said, this is interesting, but this was not sarcastically that she was laughing. This was an expression of great joy. Sarah said, God has made me laugh so that all who hear will laugh with me. This is a joyous thing. She also said, who would have thought to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? for I have borne him a son in his old age. And so this was like blowing her away. It was a very joyous situation. Okay, the next part talks about Ishmael and so on. I won't get into that. And then chapter 22 is the final test that Abraham has to go through. Now, his life's far from over because he lives to 175 years old after his wife dies, who died at 127 years old. He remarried and had a whole bunch more children. And he died, as God says, full of, you know, a good old age, full of years. Okay? And he died peacefully. He wasn't at war, and he was greatly, greatly blessed by God. But he never got to the point where he himself lived long enough to be able to see this sea of people that you couldn't count like the stars. That was to come many, many, many years down the road. Chapter 22, culmination of Abraham's faith. Now, brethren, you have to realize that Abraham at this time was probably about 125. We're just guessing at that. We don't know exactly how old he was at this time, but his son was old enough to be able to be packed down, as you'll see, with firewood, climb up the mountain with it, and travel across the country and on camels and so on. And so he had to be at least a teenager and maybe a little older. And he had to be cooperative and submissive to his father. But by this time, Abraham had learned one thing. He had been told over and over and over what God was going to do. 25 years later, God did exactly what he said. Now, Abraham could have relaxed and just believed God and not tried to reason around. And he could have avoided a lot of pain in his life. But because he tried to use human reasoning, and because his wife tried to use human, or did use human reasoning, they created pain in their life and suffering that they could have avoided. But eventually, they learned that God will do what he says. And there is no question, God's big enough. Nothing stops what God says. Nothing. Zero stops it. No matter what circumstances take place, remember, in the back of Abraham's mind, you have to do what God says. Now, God was about to ask in chapter 22, as you all know, ask him to sacrifice his own son. But you remember what we read in Hebrews, the insight that you don't get from this chapter, and that is that Abraham knew that God could resurrect his son if that was necessary. In other words, whatever God said to do, he knew God was going to fulfill the promise through his son. So in verse 2, he said to Abraham, "Take now your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love." If you have a son, I watch my son with his little son, who is 3 years old. Bradford's similar age. Believe me, fathers love their sons very deeply. And you can't even put it all in words. They love their daughters too, but there's a certain thing with a son that is very strong. "Whom you love, and you go to the land of Moriah, and you offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you." I'll let you know when you get close. And so Abraham rose up early. He didn't fool around. He didn't make excuses. He didn't say, "Well, but God, you said not to murder." He could have come up with all kinds of reasons why he didn't understand this or why it didn't make sense. So Abraham rose up early in the morning, and he saddled his donkey, and he took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son, and he split the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place in which God had told him to go. And then on the third day, they traveled for 3 days. They had time to think about this. Abraham could have turned around. He could have changed his mind. He could have impeached or beseeched God and said, "Well, what, you know, show me what you're doing here. This doesn't make any sense." But he was past that. God had shown him, and he had grown in faith to the point where he totally, 100% trusted what God said. And so Abraham said to the young men, "You stay here with the donkey, and the lad and I will go up yonder and worship, and we will come back to you." Now, he knew they were coming back to them. He didn't know how this was going to work out, but he'd already learned when God says to do it, you do it, and God will fulfill what he says. So Abraham took the wood and of the burnt offering. He laid it on Isaac, his son, and he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and the two of them went up the mountain. Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father. He said, "Well, look," he said, "you've got the fire and you've got the wood. This isn't the first time he'd ever seen an offering. But where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" And Abraham said, "My son, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering." And the two of them went together. And then what transpired here is, you have to read into this a little bit. This is pretty incredible. Then they came to the place of which God had told him. And you see there's this communication constantly between Abraham and God. And Abraham built an altar there, placed the wood in order, and he bound Isaac, his son, and laid him on the altar upon the wood. Now just think about that. I mean, that son had to be pretty submissive. He had to understand. He had to trust God as well. He allowed himself to be tied up. Obviously, if it was a young man, he could overpower his dad pretty easily at 100 years old, or 125 at this case, probably. And he laid him out on the altar. He pulled out the sharp knife in verse 10. And he stretched out his hand, and he took the knife to slay his son. And so as far as he was concerned, the knife's coming down. It's a done deal. I am going to do what God said. His mind, it was totally committed to do it. And when God saw that in verse 11, and the angel of the Lord called him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham," and he said, "Well, here I am." And he said, "Do not lay your hand upon the lad or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." Did he have works to back up his faith? I think he did. And God respected that. So then Abraham looked over in the bushes, and there was a ram. That became the offering, exactly the way Abraham said, God will provide the offering. And they did that. And they came on back down the mountain. And verse 15, "And the angel of the Lord called Abraham a second time out of heaven and said, 'By myself I have sworn, says the Eternal, because you have done this thing,'" you did this, these are actions that backed up and supported your faith, "because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, in blessing I will bless you, and in multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and as the sand which is upon the seashore, and your descendants shall possess the gates of their enemies. And in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." And so he returned, and the story goes on from there, but talking about Isaac. But this was the ultimate test as far as Abraham was concerned. And because he did what God said without question, but he didn't, what wouldn't have been able to do that, and God didn't ask him to do that 25, 30 years before, did he? He had to build Abraham's faith through time, and Abraham had to learn about faith and how to trust God and what to do. And the same for us. Every day, you know, these stories were read when I was a teenager in the church, and they have been very helpful to me. And I hope they stick in the minds of some of our young people as well as the adults because it is important for us to use these examples which were written for us and for our admonition so that we wouldn't make the same mistakes. We don't want to use human reasoning. We want to follow and do what God says, no matter what it may look like, because God says, you know, he's going to fulfill and do what he said. He's going to take care of us. He's going to support us. He will bless us for being obedient. Later on, I closed the Bible here on this, but later on in relationship to Isaac, God reiterates the fact that I'm blessing you because your father Abraham obeyed my principles and did what I said. And those the angels, when they were talking with Abraham, he said, I know, for as far as Abraham is concerned, that he will command his house to obey my laws and my rules. Now, it doesn't mean that his children, once they got out of his house, were necessarily going to do it. But as long as they were under his jurisdiction, Christ already knew that he would make sure that his family did exactly what God said. So hopefully we can remember some of these principles when we run into problems. We can use them to strengthen us, and we can continue to ask God to build our faith, because it's something that comes over time. It does not come immediately. God does not put you into some difficult trials when you are first converted, as unfortunately, well, I shouldn't say unfortunately, but as we grow in strength, then our trials can become a little stronger, but we are ready to deal with them. So hopefully we will use this to help us live by faith.